Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the April 20th and April 27th editions of People Magazine, the April edition of Women's Health, and Oprah Daily, the online newsletter. A few of the articles that I'll share today include The Rebirth of Lena Dunham, The Functional Lab Test Fixation, and 3 Simple Ways to Curb Your Sugar Cravings. The Rebirth of Lena Dunham. The girl's creator is back in the spotlight and feeling better than ever as she opens up about chronic illness, addiction, relationships, and her complicated path to stardom in a new book. By Alex Ross, photographs by Winnie Au. This is from People Magazine. When asked about her pet pigs, Victor and Cherry, Lena Dunham lights up. She adopted Victor in 2024, with Cherry to follow, during what she calls a breather from contemplating the obstacles to parenthood. I was really asking myself, okay, since you are not a person who's going to get magically pregnant one night, you need to really look at what life would look like if you decided that you weren't going to be a parent in the traditional way, she says. Dunham, 39, had a hysterectomy in 2017 after endometriosis, a condition in which tissue similar to the uterine lining grows in places it doesn't belong, left her in constant pain from damage, worse than anyone had imagined. In her new memoir, Fame Sick, she writes about her health saga, an addiction to Klonopin, making girls, dating, and coming of age. This has definitely been the most public period of my life since the almost 10 years that girls went off the air, she says. And it's cool to see how different it is for me this time around. Dunham, who was born in New York City to artists Lori Simmons and Carol Dunham, skyrocketed to fame in 2012 with the creation of Girls, about 4 young millennials messily navigating life in Brooklyn. She was only 23 when HBO called to offer her the pilot deal that changed her life. The whirlwind of attention overwhelmed her, but she says writing her new book has helped her find peace. I will confess, I've never rewatched Girls since it was on. Not because I don't think I wouldn't like it, she says. It's just that when I have time, I want to watch other people's work. Still, she considers it a great gift that Girls is resonating with a new generation. I think when I first got out of Girls, a lot of it was about proving I have more in me, that this isn't my whole story, she says. And now there's just a deep appreciation that this young person felt bold enough to put a TV show together. That cast was so down for the ride. It's amazing that it happened. Her perspective today is hard won. Dunham has weathered her share of controversies. In 2014, an anecdote in her book, Not That Kind of Girl, about childhood behavior with her sibling, left her publicly accused of molestation. Both siblings denied any wrongdoing. And in 2017, she defended a writer she worked with after he was accused of sexual assault, a statement she calls in the book careless, blithe, and damaging. Dunham also got sober in 2018. She was addicted to benzodiazepines, having been prescribed Klonopin and other medications for years for her debilitating anxiety and pain from endometriosis and the connective tissue disorder Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. We have such a specific cultural depiction of what addiction looks like. And if something's prescribed and your name is on the bottle, in some way, you think you are better or a different kind of user. And then, as you start to hear more addiction stories, you realize they all have the same hallmarks. We're all trying to keep pain at bay. Emotional, physical, spiritual, she says. Quoting the addiction expert, Johan Hari, who said that the option of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection. And that's all Denham says she ever wanted, simply to connect. She writes candidly about her relationship with musician Jack Antonoff, whom she dated from 2012 to 2017, and how it unraveled alongside her physical health. She calls him a good man, but notes, looking back, it's hard to understand why two people with seemingly endless options, financial freedom, and almost nothing that they still enjoyed doing together besides talking crap about the occasional third party would not simply break up. She chronicles the intensity of working alongside Girls co-star Adam Driver, whom she had a crush on and also found confusing. The more I knew him, the less I understood. The book details the complex bond between her and Girls co-showrunner, Jenny Connor, with whom she no longer speaks. And while Famesick takes each former relationship gently to task, there is nobody she holds more accountable than herself. You realize there's a common denominator issue here. Besides the fact that everyone's name seemed to start with the J, I was the common denominator in my relationships, she said. No one I wrote about who was part of my work life is a villain. It's just that I had not yet established the tools. I couldn't always be honest because I didn't always know what I needed. Though she's nervous about the book coming out, she says her family, her parents, brother Cyrus, 34, and husband, Louis Felber, 39, a British musician she married in 2021 after a mutual friend set them up, all have her back. It's funny. The idea of strangers reading these incredibly intimate things somehow doesn't distress me, even though it's a bit like one of those dreams where you show up naked at school. These days, Denham splits her time between her house in Connecticut and a London home she shares with Felber, whom she calls an effervescently kind person. Together, they hope to build a pig sanctuary in Connecticut where people can connect with animals. Whether they're getting sober, or their children have disabilities, or they're elderly, Denham says. She's also gearing up to turn 40 in May, exploring plans with her husband to expand their family, and finally feeling at home in her own skin. Occasionally, I'll run into something in which somebody makes a comment about my weight or my appearance, and it does not affect me the same way that it used to, because I am so aware of what my body is doing for me. And while her health is always a work in progress, she adds that right now there's an ability to care for myself and be cared for that I didn't have for a long time. If you told me when I was 22 that I'd be like, I feel excited and grateful to wake up, I would have laughed at you. But I do. Girls, Life and Beyond. Voice of a Generation. Those girls will be my sisters for the rest of my life, says Dunham of Girls co-stars Allison Williams, Jemima Kirk, and Zosia Mamet. Art Imitates Life. Megan Stalter starred in Too Much, a semi-autobiographical 2025 Netflix comedy series Dunham created with husband Felber. Back on set. Dunham is directing the upcoming Netflix film Good Sex, starring Natalie Portman, Mark Ruffalo, Meg Ryan, Rashida Jones, and Role Model. This has been The Rebirth of Lena Dunham from People Magazine. Prince's Private World. A decade after the death of one of the most celebrated musicians in history, a new photo book, an ex-wife, Maite Garcia, reveals sides of him that few people were able to ever see. By Angelo Andaloro, this is from People Magazine. On April 21st, 2016, the world was rocked by the news that Prince had died at age 57 of an accidental overdose at his home, Paisley Park, in Chanhassen, Minnesota. The entertainer had been privately dealing with a long-time opioid addiction, stemming from his attempts to manage physical pain caused by years of high-impact performances. It's been hard, his ex-wife, singer Maite Garcia, 52, tells People, reflecting on the 10-year anniversary of his death. For a good 5 years, it was really harsh, because his death happened so suddenly. I can't believe it's 10 years. Life goes really fast. Her pain is compounded by the loss of their son, Amir, who died in infancy and would have turned 30 this year. Now, a decade after the tremendous loss of the Purple Rain superstar, rarely seen photos of him are the subject of the new book, Prince, Black, White, Color, by Steve Park, out April 14th from ACC Art Books. The collection shows the photographer's work with Prince between 1996 and 2001. The photos capture Prince in his prime, from sensual solo poses to special moments with Garcia, who was married to Prince from 1996 to 2000. Prince was old school. He'd never leave the house without looking amazing, like Marilyn Monroe. You'd never catch him in sweatpants and no makeup. So we were always ready, Garcia says. Back then, we were always on. That's how he lived. Park first connected with Prince in the late 1980s, and they developed a relationship over the years that blossomed as Prince asked Park if they could work together with digital cameras, which were emerging media at the time. Prince loved being able to see and download photos right there on the spot, the control it gave him over his image, Park writes in the book, and he loved the endless possibilities of the early photoshopping effects and tricks, though I tried not to abuse them. The photos in the book include a sweet moment between Prince and Garcia and one of the couple's dogs, a Yorkie named Mia. We were just shooting and having fun. That was at the house in Spain, and Prince told me to put Mia on the piano, Garcia says with a laugh. I see them, and it brings me back to being young. I'm not saying that life is over, but it just takes me back and also makes me appreciate it. Park recalls that Prince preferred to shoot at home because it gave him room to experiment with his look. So, too, did working with digital cameras. Every bit of it was on the fly, pure trial and error, Park writes. After each individual shoot, we'd grab my laptop and review the images. Prince would sit behind me and tell me which images to keep and which to delete. An efficient method, but also unfortunate, because at that point in tech history, there was no easy way to recover deleted files. And he did ask, and of course, I'd love to have all those images lost to history. While Park is honoring Prince's legacy with the book, Garcia, who lives in Las Vegas with her 14-year-old daughter Gia, has continued to shepherd the music and arts advocacy charity Live for Love that she and Prince launched nearly 30 years ago in honor of their late son. Of course, Prince was a genius, but a lot of people don't know how much he cared and wanted to help, she says. He helped a lot of people. You've been listening to Prince's Private World from People Magazine. The functional lab test fixation. How many biomarkers do you really need to check to be healthy? By Tiana Soto from Women's Health. There are a host of new functional medicine companies that want your blood. It's true, trendy subscription services like Function Health and Inside Tracker claim to decode your biomarkers, data points that hint at what's going on in your body through blood work. Sounds cool, right? Getting one may be tempting for quick answers to hard-to-solve health problems. But before you explore, know that whether you really need one is up for debate. If you're generally healthy and have a primary care doc, you might have started getting a standard or traditional lab panel at occasional physicals in your 20s or 30s. What's typically included? A complete blood count, CBC, a comprehensive metabolic panel, CMP, and a basic cholesterol panel, says Ali Butazari, MD, an internal and lifestyle medicine physician at Main Street Medical. The standard tests include about 30 markers in total, and they often cover enough bases when it comes to screening for common risk factors such as high cholesterol or early signs of metabolic disease. Functional comprehensive lab tests, on the other hand, can include up to hundreds of biomarkers, and they usually aren't covered by insurance, making them pretty pricey. These tests might look at hormone metabolites, nutrient levels, inflammation markers, gut microbiome diversity, or advanced cardiometabolic risk factors, Dr. Butazari says. The comprehensive tests feel new and exciting, in part thanks to our collective cultural interest in longevity right now. Plus, the functional medicine field has grown due to patients feeling dismissed by traditional systems. They're seeking answers they haven't found elsewhere, says Dr. Butazari. Extensive lab testing gives patients a sense of agency. For a long time, the gatekeeping of blood work was entirely up to the provider. Here, experts break down what's fact versus fiction regarding these lab tests and if they're actually worth the money. The claim: everyone should get a functional, comprehensive blood test done. Science says, not really. If you're generally healthy, you have no need for extensive blood work. The traditional tests cover enough of the bases, plus many of the tests offered by functional med companies, such as glucose, calcium, kidney, and thyroid panels, as well as HIV and STI screenings, are routinely recommended by primary care physicians and gynecologists anyway, says Eleanor Yusupov, DO, an assistant professor at New York Institute of Technology's Medical School. In theory, your doc should let you know if you absolutely need more testing. The claim: functional tests provide additional insight that typical tests might miss. Science says, in some cases, traditional lab tests may not be sufficient for people with specific health issues, like heart disease, anemia, or diabetes, Dr. Yusupov says. In cases like these, your doctor should run additional tests for your condition, as well as a standard blood panel. If they don't, that's where comprehensive functional testing may come in. You could also be a good candidate for comprehensive testing if there's a certain health mystery, like unexplained symptoms, you're trying to figure out, or if you have a family history of a chronic condition, such as an autoimmune disease, and want more information, says Pooja Gidwani, MD, a physician in internal and obesity medicine and a concierge doctor. These more intensive panels can detect early physiological shifts that may happen years before a diagnosis, like elevated ApoB signaling cardiovascular risk, and help personalize interventions, which allow us to act before problems become diagnoses, Dr. Gidwandi adds. A good reminder here: biomarkers are just one piece of the wellness puzzle. If you have unanswered questions about your health, it's also important to look at the big picture and see what might be making you feel off, such as a lack of sleep or other lifestyle habits. The claim: functional tests are great if you're just super into health optimization and want all the data. Science says yes and no. Even the best data has its limits. Comprehensive tests often include biomarkers that aren't yet supported by strong clinical evidence and can cause needless worry. Just because we can test something doesn't always mean we should, Dr. Budarazi says. Ordering large panels without a clear clinical question can lead to overdiagnosis, unnecessary follow-ups, anxiety, financial burden, and even potential harm from false positives or incidental findings. Sometimes, Dr. Budarazi's patients will ask about numbers that show up in red on standard blood test results and don't matter medically. Their feeling of unease can increase tenfold with comprehensive functional testing becoming a major mental stressor. Some results may fall into a gray zone, not necessarily harmful, but not proven helpful either, she says. Testing is a tool, not a diagnosis. What matters most is how we interpret results, based on symptoms, goals, and lifestyle. How to navigate your biomarkers. If you want extensive labs done, clarify your goal on the front end and make sure you're working with a professional. First, think about what you're aiming to solve. Ask, what specific question am I trying to answer, and how will this result change my daily habits? Dr. Budarazi says, for instance, maybe you're experiencing strange symptoms during menopause. Or maybe you eat a plant-based diet and are wondering about B12 and iron. Vegans and vegetarians are generally at risk of running low on them. These biomarkers aren't included in a traditional panel. Then, schedule a visit with your doc to discuss whether a more comprehensive set of blood tests is the best solution for you. A good provider won't dismiss you, Dr. Budarazi says. You want a partner in your health, not just a technician. This way, you're able to evaluate everything in context with a trusted provider who can give a full picture of your health. This has been the Functional Lab Test Fixation from Women's Health. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Three simple ways to sleep better tonight. Didn't sleep a wink last night? These expert tips will turn things around. By Michelle Ross, published March 27th, 2026. This is from Oprah Daily. Welcome to our new column, Start Somewhere, which breaks down complex topics like gut health, emotional well-being, and personal finance into three simple but impactful actions you can take today. We all have to start somewhere, right? So take that first step with us. In an ideal world, sleep would be as simple and effortless as breathing. But for many of us, falling and staying asleep is as challenging as an Olympic sport. And just like a triple axle in figure skating, it requires training. According to William Liu, MD, the medical director of the virtual sleep medicine clinic, Dream Health, most sleep advice is tailored around long-term habits to help recalibrate your circadian rhythm. Your brain doesn't reset overnight, he says. It needs repeated cues at the same times to shift hormone release, body temperature patterns, and alertness rhythms. That reality isn't always helpful when you need relief, ASAP, but there is some good news. Even if your schedule isn't perfectly aligned just yet, you can do a few things to sleep better starting tonight. Some small tweaks can reduce friction and nudge your brain out of alert mode and into safe-to-sleep mode, says Dr. Lou Stewart, with these. Number one, go outside ASAP. Turns out, a better night's sleep starts during the daytime. Early morning light exposure initiates your body's master clock, says Dr. Lou, the part of your brain that regulates when you feel awake and when you feel sleepy. Like clockwork, that early hit of sun will get you on track to start secreting melatonin, also known as the sleep hormone, about 14 to 16 hours later. To reap the benefits every day, Dr. Liu says, head outdoors for 10 to 15 minutes, or up to 30 minutes on cloudy days shortly after waking. If this is when you normally jog or walk your dog, you're ahead of the game. If not, build the habit into something you already do, like drinking your coffee on the patio. Your body thrives on consistency, and this simple cue can pay off hours later, day in and day out. Number two, release a few worries. Brain too busy and anxious to fall asleep? Journaling can help offload the mental clutter. Try writing down tomorrow's worries and a first step to address each concern tomorrow, earlier in the evening, says Diane Zellman, PhD, a psychologist, sleep specialist, and professor at the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. Putting pen to paper can minimize the stressy sleeplessness that lingers after the lights go out. Number three, don't pop a pill, put on socks. Your core body temperature needs to lower by a degree or two to initiate sleep. And surprisingly, putting on socks before bedtime can actually speed things along. When your feet warm up, blood vessels near the skin all over your body dilate and help release heat from your core, which accelerates a natural temperature drop, says Dr. Liu. That shift is one of the biological signals your brain uses to initiate sleep. It's simple, it's low effort, and it can work quickly, making it one of the easiest tweaks to try tonight. You have been listening to Three Simple Ways to Sleep Better Tonight from Oprah Daily. Pilates people, as the method grows glitzier and more gatekept, a wave of women are fighting to reclaim the reformer for the rest of us. By Amy Wilkinson, photographs by Leon Benoit, styled by Jasmine Fontana. This is from Women's Health Magazine. Accessible, inclusive, welcoming. You've likely seen the word splashed across studio windows and all over your social feeds, perhaps in some millennial soft beige font. Pilates, we're told, is for everybody. And in theory, these words reflect the roots of the method, created in the early 1900s by German boxer and fitness educator Joseph Pilates. Many of the apparatuses he patented, like the reformer, were designed to assist practitioners in Pilates' signature exercises, training wheels for more strenuous mat moves so everyone could do them. In practice, however, these adjectives can ring hollow today, given that many studios still reflect some of the whitest, most affluent spaces in wellness. In recent months, a number of TikTok influencers have reinforced this notion via video clips extolling the modality as a luxury or privilege, or accusing Black practitioners of trying to align themselves with whiteness through Pilates. Even without toxic rhetoric, studios may unintentionally be unwelcoming, whether due to high price points, racial biases, or branding that appeals to thin white women. The gap between Pilates' original vision and the reality of the modern practice is real, but so is the pushback. Across the country, a new guard of instructors and founders is challenging who gets to take up space in the studio and who gets to embody a Pilates person. All sizes welcome. Lindsay Leaf likes showing off what her body is capable of, especially when she can quickly squelch harmful stereotypes, and preconceived notions in the process. I've always been naturally athletic, says the 43-year-old creator of Fat Body Pilates, which advocates and educates on size inclusivity and accessibility in Pilates. I can do things that people don't necessarily expect. A high school volleyball and softball player, Leaf was referred to Pilates after a yoga injury landed her in physical therapy more than a decade ago. Leaf has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, a genetic condition that weakens the body's connective tissues. One symptom is hypermobile joints that can be more prone to injury, particularly if she pushes her range of motion too far. Coincidentally, a club Pilates had recently opened near Leaf's home in the Twin Cities. So she began taking classes with the other newbies, focusing on the foundations of the method. There was definitely a learning curve, but I started to feel a lot more powerful in my body, tapping into some of the more stabilizing, smaller muscles that help us utilize our bigger muscles more effectively, she says. Despite her growing mastery, Leaf couldn't help but notice that few people in the studio, students or teachers, had a body like hers. She began to wonder if there were trainers elsewhere who had more experience with and could better support larger frames. An instructor friend referred her to Balanced Body, and Leaf loved the organization's scientific, rehab-friendly approach. My original intention wasn't to go the distance and get full comprehensive training. I just wanted to be able to better advocate for my own body, she says. But after encouragement from a mentor and others, she decided to go through with it. Then, in 2019, once again seeing a lack of representation in the Pilates community, she started her social media account, @FatBodyPilates. I honestly didn't expect anything to come of it, she says. Leaf's hope was simply that someone might stumble onto her account, see themselves, and use it as a resource. But as interest in Pilates has exploded over the past 5 years, so too has Leaf's follower count. While a good portion of the feedback has been positive, she's been the target of nasty comments too. I'm at the point with this whole Instagram journey where people are like, oh, that's AI. Big bodies can't do that. The number of times I have gotten that comment over the past couple months is insane. But Leaf is undeterred, and not so long ago, she took her work a step further by launching a size-inclusive Pilates workshop, which educates teachers on prejudices and on strategies to make studio spaces and exercises more comfortable for bigger bodies. To do so, however, she had to tamp down a nagging case of imposter syndrome, eventually reaching the conclusion, if not me, who? And just as with her social media experience, low expectations quickly turned into meaningful impact. I've trained at least 200 instructors at this point, Leaf says. Anything I can put out into the world to help somebody who walks into a studio feel like they are understood and we know how to work with their bodies is the best thing. Building on Black History. Sonia R. Price Herbert, 57, took her first mat class back in 2006. She couldn't do a lot of the exercises. I'm very competitive, so I thought, I am going to learn this, Herbert says. After taking a couple of classes, I just got addicted. So hooked, in fact, that Herbert, who was employed as a social worker in New York City at the time, completed her MAT teacher training. Not long after, she enrolled in a comprehensive training program so she could teach on all apparatuses. Herbert was the only Black person who finished the training. Just one of the instructors was Black. I was like, surely there have to be more Black teachers than this, she recalls. Soon after she completed her training, Herbert took a hiatus from social work and taught Pilates full-time. Whether she was working at a big-name gym or a smaller boutique studio, she continued to feel like an anomaly. Over time, Herbert slowly assembled a small group of Black mentors who helped her feel less alone. It was one of those mentors, an instructor named Deanne Harvey Salam, who told her about the oft-overlooked Black pioneer of Pilates, a woman named Kathy Stanford Grant. A dancer and choreographer, Stanford Grant was a Pilates elder, one of a handful of instructors who were trained directly by Pilates himself. Though she died in 2010, she helped popularize the method, and her legacy endures. Herbert launched Black Girl Pilates on the anniversary of her death 7 years later. It was just happenstance, she says, of the serendipitous timing. The founding of Black Girl Pilates was inspired by earlier endeavors by Salam and others to start a community group for Pilates instructors of color. It never quite got off the ground. They are the folks who planted the seed, Herbert says. I was just able to cultivate it. Over the past 9 years, Black Girl Pilates has offered a space, sometimes physical, sometimes virtual, for Black instructors to find community, mentorship, and education. Even in the relatively short amount of time she's been running the organization, Herbert has seen a shift in representation. Now that folks are opening their own studios and buying franchises, there are more people getting certified because they're able to see themselves, she says. Whereas before, they weren't really seeing themselves. They didn't know if Black people even did Pilates. They didn't know if we even had anything to do with Pilates. And then, come to find out, we had a big part of it. Through supporting instructors and studio owners, Herbert believes more Black folks will come to Pilates. And while Stanford Grant's legacy serves as a reminder of Pilates' Black lineage, Herbert encourages people of color to make their own mark. Our history doesn't start and end with Kathy Stanford Grant, she says. She was the foundation. We put the bricks on top of it. The price is right. After a decade of teaching Pilates in chain gyms and small studios, Lori Crosswaite, a former dancer, decided to open a studio of her own. She wanted to cultivate her voice as an instructor and control operations the way she saw fit. And one of her goals, to be able to offer sliding scale pricing. Everyone has a right to a really robust and meaningful movement practice of some kind, and that requires education, which requires a teacher, says 39-year-old Crosswaite, who opened Pilates Homeroom in New Orleans in 2019. As a teacher in a movement education space, there's a responsibility to cultivate opportunities for people regardless of their ability to pay. Pilates Homeroom offers both sliding scale and scholarship options. Crossweight sliding scale comprises three tiers based on a student's financial situation. Tier 1 is a 50% discount for those struggling to meet their basic needs. Tier 2 is a 20% discount for those who can meet their basic needs but have little to no disposable income. Tier 3 is full price with no discount, which helps offset the other two tiers. Crossweight based her scale on the green bottle method, created by herbalist and writer Alexis J. Cunning Folk, who views a sliding scale as a tool of economic justice. Scholarship allows select students to take classes at no cost and are also offset by full price fees, says Crossweight, which helps nurture and support the community of regular students at Homeroom Pilates. For people in the community who are paying at the top of the sliding scale, I think it is maybe affirming or a feel-good investment for them to know that when they do that, they're supporting a scholarship student, she says. We're all contributing to this ecosystem, and that's what makes it sustainable. Everyone gets to participate. During any given week, about 25% of Crossweight's roster is composed of sliding scale and scholarship students. When asked if she's ever worried people might take advantage of the system, she says no. If that's happening, I don't know about it, she says. With many classes costing far more than other forms of exercise, it can be difficult for newcomers to even consider Pilates. It's my firm belief that the people who need it the most have the hardest time choosing it in the first place. That's why Crossweight makes her pricing as transparent as possible. It's clearly posted on her website, so people don't have to go searching for it or email about it. It's not a secret that I offer sliding scale pricing, she says. Making the method accessible is also about Crossweight's way of teaching for comprehension versus consumption. Helping students understand the principles instead of simply going through the motions of a workout. If we can teach for comprehension, then we start to deconstruct the gatekeeping around Pilates, she says. Yes, my time costs. Yes, my skills and attention and expertise cost. But doing Pilates is not actually expensive over time if your investment has been worthwhile and you have learned well. Autonomous practice is actually rooted in the bedrock of the Pilates method, originally called Controlology. Pilates himself wrote in his book, Return to Life Through Controlology, in 1945. Controlology doesn't demand your joining a gymnasium, nor the purchasing of expensive apparatus. You may derive all the benefits of Controlology in your own home. Crossweight is once again giving her students more options. There's still longevity as a teacher, even if I'm empowering students to practice on their own. You've been listening to Pilates People from Women's Health Magazine. Three simple ways to curb your sugar cravings The Secret, Prioritize What You Love, and Nix What Is Truly Unnecessary by Christina Mannion, published April 9th, 2026, from Oprah Daily. Sorry to be a buzzkill, but you're probably eating way too much sugar. This isn't a personal attack. It's a we problem. Per the American Heart Association, American adults consume an average of 17 teaspoons of added sugar per day, nearly three times the daily recommended maximum of 6 teaspoons, or 25 grams, for women. The key word is added. You don't need to worry about the naturally occurring sugars in foods like fruit. We mean the table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, brown rice syrup, and in some cases, maple syrup or honey used to make stuff taste sweeter. Going overboard on these ingredients can result in some pretty serious health outcomes. Over time, too much added sugar can lead to increased insulin resistance and chronic inflammation, both of which raise the risk of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic illnesses, says Jamie Adams, MS, RDN, a registered dietitian specializing in women's health. These risks become more significant after menopause, when a woman's cardiovascular risk naturally rises. The menopause transition can also make it harder for your body to keep blood sugar balanced, making even the littlest treats more likely to cause energy dips, brain fog, and mood swings. But cutting back can be daunting if you have a sweet tooth. 25 grams of added sugar is pretty standard in a single margarita, a mini can of soda, a small dessert, or a few fun-sized candy bars, leaving little room for the sugar from sneakier sources, like salad dressings, sauces, bread, and flavored yogurt. It's a bitter pill to swallow. Thankfully, you can have your cake and eat it too. The key is prioritizing the treats that bring you real pleasure. When women cut back on the hidden sugar in everyday foods, it often creates room to enjoy dessert or a favorite flavored coffee creamer on purpose, says Allie McGowan, MSRD, a registered dietitian and founder of Sprout Out Loud. Here are three simple ways to get started. Number one, audit your staples. Start by nixing the sources of added sugar already hiding in your kitchen. Condiments, salad dressings, pasta sauces, and flavored creamers often contain several grams of added sugar per serving that add up quickly. But they're rarely the foods people truly enjoy, Adams says. Switching to lower or no sugar versions is one of the easiest ways to lower intake without feeling deprived. Same goes for flavored yogurts, granola, and protein bars, which can have up to 10 to 15 grams of added sugar per serving, added McGowan. Number two, rethink your drinks. Even if you're not a soda person, there's probably some hidden sugar in your drink rotation too. Sweetened coffee and tea, smoothies, and soda can quietly deliver a full day's worth of added sugar without providing much fullness, says Adams. Consider this your sign to embrace seltzer, water, and herbal teas already. You don't have to go cold turkey, which we understand sounds miserable. Instead, make tweaks slowly to allow your taste to adjust. If you add 2 sugar packets to your coffee, start by decreasing to 1.5 and continue from there, says Rebecca Jaspan, MPH, RD, a registered dietitian and owner of Rebecca Jaspan Nutrition. Number 3, upgrade your snacks. The other part of reducing your sugar intake is working with your biology to ward off cravings. McGowan recommends incorporating a source of protein and fat into your meals and snacks, like pairing an apple with a handful of walnuts or an ounce of cheddar. This supports blood sugar control and reduces the urge to have something sweet an hour later. She says, you'll be less tempted to tear into that box of cookies at 9 p.m., blowing your sugar budget for the day in one episode of Summer House. This has been 3 simple ways to curb your sugar cravings from Oprah Daily. Thank you for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the program today, and will join us again next week for another interesting collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget that you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as access shows on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona apps for both Apple and Android. Have a great day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.